session with 31402, reel 1.
Fred Walton, reel 1.
My name is Fred Walton. In 1937, I enlisted in the Royal Tank Corps, as it was then known. I served in the 7th Battalion of that unit until I was taken POW in 1942. During all my service, I was, for some obscure reason, always known as Joe. My unit was on the Derner Road in Tobruk on the 21st of June 1942, having been withdrawn into there when all their tanks were lost on the outskirts of Tobruk. We were all stood to at first light as German artillery shells were bursting overhead. Eventually, from high authority came the order, every man for himself. What to do? A party of maybe 10 of us decided to walk towards the sea to ascertain if it was possible to get along the coast towards Egypt. We thought it was useless to try to head for the desert, as it was obvious that Tobruk was surrounded by the Germans. Although it was very hot, we had managed to get almost to the cliffs on the seashore, when on one side of us appeared a large German Tiger tank, and on the other side a large German armoured car. I don't think anything was said, but from the indications from the tank and the armoured car, it was obvious that they meant for us to turn round and head back into Tobruk Harbour. Maybe it was foolish, but we all took out our 38 revolvers and what ammunition we had and flung them over the cliff into the sea. We then commenced the long walk back to Tobruk Harbour, realising that we were prisoners of war. All right. Although I am now 91 years of age, I still remember most of the events that occurred and where I was during the next 3 years, when we were eventually released. On eventual arrival in Tobruk Harbour, it really was chaos, trying to sort people out into their own units. I always understood that if captured, you did not tell your captors your unit, but here all units were being shouted out to get together. I'm not sure, but I think they said it was 30,000 prisoners all jammed together in Tobruk Harbour. To add to the confusion, the German column, who were advancing along the road towards Egypt, were all stopping to take photographs of us for propaganda purposes. This made the situation worse than ever, until there was no movement at all. After a while, commotion, everything began to move, cameras put away quickly. Why? Because who should appear on the scene in the staff car but the man himself, Erwin Rommel, complete with goggles above the peak of his hat, his trademark. It had to be seen to be believed, but he had everyone jumping about and all traffic jam had been sorted out within a few minutes of his arrival. We did not stay long in Tobruk Harbour. I think the Germans did provide us with some water, but I cannot remember any food forthcoming. Eventually, a large fleet of Italian lorries arrived. It seems that international law says that POWs must be handed over to whatever country owns the place of capture. In our case, it was Libya, which was owned by the Italians. They started loading, or should I say jabbing us into those vehicles, all standing, hardly room to turn round. Set off on desert road, all sand, of course. So we travelled with a dust storm round us all the time. I do not know the distance we travelled, but it was Tobruk to the outskirts of Tripoli. Certainly hundreds of miles, and once again I cannot recall any food or water being provided. Sat on the cab of each vehicle was a Sanusi. This was a desert tribesman with a rifle. Whenever we stopped for bodily functions, if he thought you were being a long time, he would put his rifle up and put a bullet near you to hurry you up. Eventually we arrived at Tahuna on the outskirts of Tripoli, our home for the next 6 months. Nothing there but desert, large concrete buildings with barbed wire around everything. Inside was just concrete floor, no beds or bedding, floor running with urine from previous occupants. Sleep on floor to the best of your ability. Food was one small bread cake per day, soup with a few grains of rice in, very little except water, one ladle per day, one ersatz coffee per day, which I understand was ground roasted acorns, no sweetening. Whatsoever, this was certainly a hellhole. Not for the treatment, but it was absolutely soul-destroying. A sergeant from the Worcester Regiment got some of his men together, and they were, with disinfectant, etc., provided by the Italians, managed to clear the mess in the toilets and make them usable. Water was a few taps at the end of the camp. This was for all the thousands of us that were there. This water was turned off every morning until evening. I suppose this was to conserve the water with it being in the desert. Food, I think here, the Italians had very little for themselves. Actually, nothing but sheer boredom. Our sleeping quarters were locked up during the day, so we were out in the sun most of the day. Chief occupation was listening to anyone who could talk on any subject under the sun. Some were quite good, but the best was by a man called Bert Ramelson, an out-and-out communist. I often wondered what he was doing in the British Army, although I never saw him again after this camp. He must have survived, because on a trip to Leeds after the war, I saw posters everywhere saying, "Vote for Ramelson, your communist candidate." If I recall, his lectures at the camp used to be on cases he encountered in his work as in a solicitor's office. I do recall we had 5 small cigarettes issued twice in that camp. They were full of small holes, which I understand were weevil holes. One had to tear a sheet from the paybook and wrap it round the cigarette. It got a drag. A friend of mine and myself tried bark of a small tree, cut up and shredded, wrapped up in the usual paper round it and lit it. I will say we did manage a puff, but 2 puffs was sufficient, or you would have blown your head off. I wonder what sort of tree it was. At the end of 6 months, we were taken down to the docks in Tripoli. I think this was because of the advance of Allied troops from El Alamein. On the docks we were put on a fairly small boat and battened down in the hold. Obviously all the Italian sailors had life jackets on, but none for the POWs. It was a fairly rough voyage across the Mediterranean, and judging by the commotion from the deck above, I think we must have been getting away from Allied warships, etc. Whilst down in the hold, quite a few POWs passed out and were carried out and laid on deck. I suppose good fortune must have been with us because we arrived safely in Naples. We must have looked a terrible sight when we came up from the hold, because I saw a party of nuns on the land, and when they saw us, they all dropped on their knees and started praying. I hope it was for us. From the docks in Naples, we were taken to a POW camp, known as Campo Concentramento. All I can say for a POW camp, it was very nice. Bed and bedding, etc., and a bit of decent food. Unfortunately, with the advance of our troops, Italian forces were being withdrawn from Africa, and our camp was needed for them. Next move was a fairly long one to Porto San Giorgio in northeast Italy on the Adriatic coast. Once again, complete boredom. Large hangar where we slept in 3-tier wooden beds. Dry straw in the palliasses, which meant bottom and middle bed were always showered with dry dust. One small electric light to light a huge building. Not long before we were all lousy, which meant you spent hours every day hunting fleas and lice in the seams of your clothing. Obviously no work, because we were in the middle of nowhere again. Little bit of progress made with entertainment. Started getting a show together. Anyone who could do anything was rewarded with a bone out of the Italian cookhouse. There was no meat on it, but I think it was the thought of it that made it a magnet. I think eventually the Italians supplied some sort of musical instruments. Biggest blessing of all here was we started receiving Red Cross parcels. Invariably one between 2, but it was still manna from heaven. A piece of the camp was set aside as a brewing pitch with English tea and coffee from the Red Cross parcels. All empty tins were put to use, and it was a revelation to see the different kinds of stove, etc., which had been made from empty tins. Eventually, we hear that Italy has been invaded, and the Italians are advancing towards us. 3 in a week, even the Italian guards had been taken down from the walls, and black shirt uniforms had been changed for royalist garb. Told we could wander about, but not to go too far, or you will be mixed with fleeing Germans and may get killed. Stay where you are until our forces arrive. Lasted a couple of days, and then, what's happening? Germans closing the gates. Germans with rifles, appearing on the guard walls. End of the dream. Couple of days later, all issued with one Red Cross parcel each. Down the railway, a long line of cattle trucks approaching. Get in. You have one Red Cross parcel each for food. Each cattle truck then the enclosed type with one small air vent at the top, about 20 in each truck. Doors slammed and we are away again. God knows where. Forgot to mention that beside Red Cross parcel, we were also issued with a medium-sized bread loaf. Actually, the top of mine had come adrift, showing all green mould underneath. It also had on the date of baking, which was 1938. It was issued to me in 1944, and I must confess I ate every bit of it. I am still living at 91. We were locked in these cattle trucks for quite a few days. Worse travelling, as there was just one small vent, it was impossible to see outside, so we did not know where we were going. In the cattle truck, one corner was reserved for bodily functions. Further I know, but what could we... Filthy, but what could I do? Two incidents I do remember on that train journey was one. We stopped in a centre line between two platforms on a large railway station with lots of people stood on both platforms. We were made to dismount from the wagon so that bodily functions could be performed on the track outside in full view of all the people on both platforms. Another lesson in propaganda, I suppose. The other incident was the train was stopped all out again into a field containing large tents. Middle of night, not very warm. First strip all clothing off, next all had a haircut. This was performed on an old-fashioned sheep shearer, which was operated by two Russian prisoners of war, turning a handle 3 times over the head, one in centre, 2 and 3 at sides. Result should have been bald as a billiard ball. Actually, results varied. It depended on how quickly the Russian POWs turned the wheel. If they slowed down, hard luck, the hair came out by the roots. After this, we had into the hot showers. Meanwhile, all our clothing had been put into an incinerator affair to be steamed, I suppose cleaned. Out of the showers, no drying. Got clothes on, hot water and steamy, but we had got them on and backed on the train. I assume all this was because the Germans knew we were lousy, coming from Italy, and this was to get rid. I have to say, it seemed successful. Eventually, a train arrived at Stalag 4B, which was a massive POW camp in East Germany. I have to say that in all that time on that train, we were never once pestered with Allied aircraft. I found that unbelievable. Maybe fortunate for us. Not at Stalag 4B very long before detailed for work outside. This was 30 of us being collected by a sentry and marched with what bit of gear we had down to a railway station. We were put on a train in proper carriages and set off. The sentry, although he spoke a little English, would not tell us where we were going. Wait and see sort of attitude. Eventually we reached our destination, which was the city of Leipzig in East Germany, our home for the next 18 months. Am I doing all right? First day at the factories, sentry left us at the factory for German workers to look after us. All the Germans were elderly or sickies, each given our jobs by the German. Herr May commonly known as Dickie Bo Willie. My job was with Max, a mountain of a man, a German of course. We were in a meat carrying railway vehicle with all hooks on the roof. The meat was brought on bogies from the factory to the side of the wagon. It was all very frozen and difficult to handle. Huge sides of beef, goodness knows how much they weighed. The job was to carry the beast from the bogies to the hooks in the wagon. So when all the wagons were loaded, the train was then taken to wherever it was going. After being a POW for 18 months, I was not feeling very strong. After about 20 minutes struggling to lift one of these heavy animals, I think I managed to hang one. Meanwhile, Max had almost filled the wagon. I did not understand a word of what he was saying to me, but he did not seem to mind my not being able to lift them. I think he understood. Towards night time, he stripped a huge fillet of beef from one of these animals and showed me how to wrap it round my tummy under my shirt so it did not show. I was shaking like a leaf until we got back to where we lived, but we managed to cook it and it was bloody lovely. From here, I cannot put things in order, so I will have to put the occurrences down as I remember them. One thing I must say is, the longer we were there, the more we felt we were running the show. Stealing of meat by Englanders became so bad that I do not know how we got away with it. The only people allowed to touch the meat were the Germans and the English POWs. This in spite of the fact that we had working there people from most of Europe, French, Belgian, Hollanders, Spaniards, Russians, but only English and Russians were POWs. All the rest were on some sort of understanding where they did not have sentries. I think in the main all German and English were stealing the meat, but the Germans only took small portions, but with the English it had to be seen to be believed. But I believe we were all at it. It was a case of silence. Regarding the factory where we lived, what happened there was simply because everyone was starving. All food was for the forces. Because of this, we were able to bribe all our sentries with the occasional gift of a piece of meat. Consequently, they turned a blind eye to what was going on. When we were cooking in our room at night, it was obvious the sentries would smell it because there was only a thin partition separating us. For air raid purposes, all major cities in Germany had two rings round them on the map. When our planes entered the outer ring, the four alarms sounded. This meant stand by. When planes entered the inner ring, this was the Richtige alarm, or the right alarm, sounded. This meant get in the cellar. The head air raid warden man was an engineer employed in the factory. So when we went into the cellar, when the alarm went, he was also there and used to get all his information regarding the raid by radio in the cellar. So of course we heard it, and eventually, although it was in German, we were eventually able to understand it. The worst message was 1,400 enemy planes over our city, escorted by 700 fighters. Stand by for bomb offloading. After one of these raids, some unexploded bombs were found on the roof of the factory. Almost immediately, two huge German vehicles arrived carrying German soldiers and a lot of people in long striped gowns, Jewish, I suppose, from the concentration camps. All went up on the roof, and eventually the bombs, having been made safe, were dragged down the stairs and onto the vehicle. Heartbreaking sight, but we could not get near the Jews to give them anything. In the factory where we lived was a large room called a katrobe. I think it meant restroom. In it was a stage, lots of chairs and a piano. Fancying myself as a producer, I managed to produce a few shows in this room. From the talent amongst us, 30 prisoners. We were fortunate to have a Wally Myers from somewhere in Yorkshire, and he was a first-class pianist. Germans who worked in the factory and some elderly residents from nearby made up the audience. All seemed to enjoy it and gave us something to do at night when we were not crouched in the cellar. Returning to the factory where I worked, Max whom I spent my first days with, just disappeared. I don't know why one did not inquire too deeply into things in those days. From then until the end of my time at the factory, I seemed to be adopted by Alfred Buchheim, an elderly German, very strong and a really good worker. He used to tell me jokes in German and laugh at them himself, and you could see his eyes light up. Just to please him, I used to have a good laugh, even though in the early days I hadn't a clue what he was talking about. You have to understand that at this factory a large number of ice blocks were made. These were for eating places and civilian use for ice boxes. This was obviously before refrigerators became so common. A delivery of these ice blocks was made by horse and cart, probably due to lack of transport. The driver of this setup was my mate Alfred, so I had to go with him delivering. Sat very high up on this cart in the middle of Leipzig, I thought I was the bee's knees. When it came to delivering the blocks of ice, it was like a wrestling match. Blocks of ice on shoulder, all cold water from it running down your neck, and the blocks sliding all over because you could not grip it with just your bare hands. When we had delivered all the ice, Alfred would take me into one of these eating places and treat me to a bowl of sauerkraut. There was nothing else to eat, everyone got the same, set menu. It was disgusting eating, but I tried to make it look as though I enjoyed it. In the office, three large wooden boxes had been made with shafts at each end for carrying, like a sedan chair. This was to put most of the valuable paperwork from the office when the four alarms sounded, which was very frequent. All the paperwork had to be put in the boxes. When the Rissich alarm sounded, boxes locked and all office staff down to the cellar. Meanwhile, English POWs were hurrying to the office to collect the wooden boxes and get them to the cellar. Nobody else was allowed to touch the boxes, only the English. Out of all the nationalities which were employed there, this was the same in the factory, nobody allowed to touch the meat, only the elderly Germans and the English. We did spend a lot of time in the cellar due to air raids, but in the worst one, I think the factory received four direct hits. It was impossible to describe what the blast was like in the ears. When we sorted out, we were trapped in the cellars. Fortunately, we were dug out by the Germans from around the area. From this one, I have had trouble with my ears since this happened. Stone deaf in the left and about 50% in the right. I think that gentleman up above must have been looking after us that day. When I say cellars, I don't mean air raid shelters. These were just normal cellars under the factory and not very deep down. After one particularly heavy raid, we expect our only rough treatment. Factory had been badly damaged and the coke lining in the coal rooms was burning. This meant getting all the meat out and conveying it to the other side of a main road, where another part of our factory had not been hit. German troops were moved into the factory to put the meat on chutes into the vehicles, where it was conveyed over the road. This is where we had been taken. In this place, which was stored many, many hundredweight barrels of Danish butter, Lerpak. The butter was going to be used elsewhere to make room for the meat. Unfortunately, there was no electricity due to the air raid, so the lifts were useless. This meant for us English prisoners a huge frozen half peg on the shoulder down three flights of stairs, return journey with a hundredweight barrel of butter on the shoulder, and then to improve matters, there was a member of the Hitler Youth on each step with a stick. I think that is enough on that, and who knows, many Hitler Youths were sent to the Russian front at the end, so maybe fate was waiting. Just some idea of the state of things, another German called Alfred, very nice gentleman, middle-aged, called up, trained, on Russian front and killed in 18 days. After the bad raid on the factory where we worked, most of our time was spent retrieving the bricks from the rubble, knocking off all the old cement and stacking, ready for, they hoped, rebuilding the main effort. The main effort was put into the production of the ice blocks because they were needed for refrigeration. Eventually, great jubilation, ice plant was back in production at 8 a.m. Alas, by 12 noon, it was flat on the floor again, another raid. During my time in Leipzig, I was taken to first aid on two occasions. First time was when I had my toe trapped under the wheel of a bogie containing 20 hundredweight barrels of butter, made rather a mess of my big toenail, which was pulled off with a small pair of pliers. Very painful. No bandages, so toe unwrapped with cheap toilet roll and put back into clogs. I've had problems ever since. When the nail was pulled off, it must have left the roots in because it grew again, but unfortunately it grew as in growing, and I have had trouble with it ever since. My second visit to first aid was marching back from factory to where we lived, wearing clogs. Deep snow on the ground at the time, and this snow balled up on the sole of my clog and caused me to fall with my left arm underneath me, made rather a mess of my wrist. Put into plaster at first aid, but thankfully it must have healed okay. This first aid was run by a man who eventually became Dr. Kidd from Pontefract. He is now retired. Couple of incidents regarding Jim, one of our fellow POWs. Separated from our factory by two lots of railway lines was a Milchhof. Not sure, but I think it was a dairy. The people working there were, I think, Belgians. On some days they were working at our factory side, so we were able to converse with them using the usual sign language. One of the Belgians was a very good-looking female. Jim had his eye on this female and certainly succeeded in his designs. This particular day, Jim was working in the usual place with a large piece of pork hidden under his jacket. Much sign language between the female and Jim. Both eventually disappeared underground. After about 20 minutes, Jim returned with a large satisfied grin on his face. Second incident was Jim had exchanged a piece of pork for a bottle of schnapps. Silly man drank the whole bottle. Result, collapsed legless. By the time the sentry came to collect us, we had Jim laid on a handcart covered in jackets. We told the sentry that he had been taken ill. I think Jim could have boasted about being pushed through the city of Leipzig on a handcart whilst inebriated, in spite of the Gestapo and the Nazis. In the room where we lived was a small trapdoor leading to outside without going past where the sentries lived. That way we were actually locked in. This trapdoor was beneath one of the beds and maybe the sentries did not know it was there. After the door was locked in the evening, there was quite a traffic of bodies through the trapdoor to the railway line outside. All sorts of nationalities knew of this rendezvous, and it resembled Petticoat Lane some nights. Pork in exchange for whatever was going. It was chiefly snaps. Two of the POWs had struck up a friendship with two of our female office workers at the factory. Most nights these particular two POWs were missing most of the night, but returning in time for work next morning. I cannot understand how on earth they escaped detection. After the worst bombing, this factory was allowed possibly six railway trucks. These were filled by us all with the factory rubbish from the bombing. When the trucks were full, they were taken by rail to a place called Espenhain, where there was a large tip. The English were taken on the back coach of a bus with a trailer to this Espenhain. Our job then was to shovel the trucks empty on the tip so they could be returned to the factory, and this process restarted. This was because there was such a shortage of railway trucks in Germany at that time.